Okay. Am I loud enough? To stem, yes, I am loud enough. Okay. I can tell that. Good morning. And if you've already had lunch, then it's good afternoon. Questions? You're easy. Okay. I want to say something about language. This is a not quite random, but totally out of context comment. I just wanted to call it to your attention, just so you'll be aware of it and think about it. This comes from reading some of the drafts on the Rules for Parenting assignment. And I was reminded again that often people use a concept when talking about what parents do or should do. Use a concept that is part of our thinking, is part of our cliche about parenting and what parents do. And I just want to call your attention to a particular word that people use very regularly. I ran across it 3 times in the last day and a half, and that is the word instill. Parents are supposed to instill into their child something, you know, an attitude or a love of nature or whatever it might be. It's a fine concept, except that you instill something by dripping it slowly in, drop by drop. Okay. So the definition of the word is to introduce very slowly. You instill something into a mixture. You instill into a vein. If you want to talk about helping the child develop a particular attitude or love of nature, you can use the word instill, but you need to follow it with by doing the following things. Okay. Because parents can't instill into a child anything. Parents can create a surrounding that encourages it. Parents can encourage particular kinds of activities. But the word instill requires that you get concrete about how you're going to do that. Because you're not going to drip it into the kid's vein. You're not going to put it in the kid's ear bit by bit. So how do you, in fact, create a love of nature or instill an attitude of some sort in a child? It's part of the process of helping you think about how you actually do these things. Where the rubber hits the road is what the parents do. And if your goal is to create something within the child, how do you do that? Wishes don't make it so. And by osmosis may work, but then you need to specify how you're going to osmote, if that's, I'm sure that's not a word, how you create a surround that encourages the child to absorb your values and your attitudes. So be more specific about how you create that environment. Okay? Does that seem like semantic harping? Yeah. But books are full of great advice. You know, do this to your child without being concrete about it. So it's important for us to think about language and what the implications are and how we would actually behave if we were going to do it. It's kind of like the children absorb knowledge by opening up the top of the skull and putting it in there. How do children absorb knowledge? Do we immerse them in it? What is the active process? Okay, I've popped enough. You've got it. Someday I'll write a book about words that we need to think about. No, I won't. Someday I'll write a brief half page on words that we need to be cautious about. Words like cause, determine, influence, they're all great words, but they have very specific meanings. Okay. Anything else I'm supposed to do? Questions? Okay. Let's see. We just bore a child, I believe, brought it home, tripled the number of dyads, increased the financial drain. In many families, decreased the financial resources by reducing the workload for one parent. We've created new roles for the first-time parents, father and mother. And we have multiplied their roles and given each parent multiple roles to try to fulfill at the same time. So your husband and father at the same time, your mother and wife at the same time, and it's important then to think about how those roles support each other, or how those roles might be in conflict with each other. It's also then helpful to, as I think I was saying at the end of class, it's helpful to have chalk. And I have two brand new, unopened boxes. It's like a birthday. I can't open them, but okay, so that's not the way I drew it last time, right? I drew it this way. That's what I had on the board, some variation of that. And we were in the middle of talking about the competition between the new dyads, the parental and child dyads, and the potential conflict or competition between the spousal dyad or interparental dyad. I like this. Almost sounds obscene. Like interparental. But anyway, and the dyad each has with the child. And so the microsystem is going to change dramatically, and it's going to particularly change to accommodate those new roles and the characteristics of babies, which are messy, and I went through all of that. So you know what babies are like, and you know what it's like to try to accommodate to them and to their schedules. And as Galinsky describes it, what we engage in then, as the baby comes, is dealing with the conflict between the image that we had, which we had developed during pregnancy and before, the image supported by the media, the image from our childhoods. All of those sources gave us an image, and now we have the reality. And that reality may be very different from what we expected. We may have a child who's just spent or is spending the first 2 weeks in intensive care. We may have a child who has disabilities. We may have a child who doesn't behave the way we expect a child to. We may have then a spouse who doesn't behave as we expected the spouse to do. Galinsky doesn't talk about that directly. She doesn't talk about the image we have of each other as parents. But we have that image. And one of the difficulties for the father and mother is going to be sorting out how they're actually playing those roles, how adept they are, how comfortable they are with those roles, and how that fits with the image that we have. It may not fit. And then most couples have to deal with the impact on the spousal relationship as they deal with the stress, as they deal with the role changes. Any change, even the ones you're looking for, remember, even the ones you're happy about, are stressful. And the whole microsystem is learning to cope with the new dyads, the new roles, the new motor activities, how to create reciprocity with the other parent in carrying out those activities and making decisions, how to support people whose roles may be changing in the mesosystem, as one parent may be working more, and that's typical. One is working less, so she has a diminished connection to the mesosystem. One of the common complaints of people in the first few months of raising an infant is that they spend all their time with infants rather than being able to hang out with adults. And then there's a whole set of decisions that have to be made as you figure out how you're going to involve other settings with the child, other people with the child. How do you deal with the grandparents? You've already probably wrestled with one, which is who is going to come and spend a month with us when the baby is born, because his mother wants to, her mother wants to, she wants to spend 3 months. And the couple doesn't want either of them there, or doesn't want one particular one there, because she doesn't deal with stress very well. She's not all that grown up herself. So the mother-in-law who's to be excluded has to be dealt with. That may cause problems in the extended family, and the couple may have to wrestle with that. So there are lots of decisions, lots of new activities, lots of connections. Who gets to spend time with the child is one of many. And then how do you get out? How do you leave the child for the first time with somebody else? How long was it, those of you who have children? Insisted. Said, you got to get out. You're going nuts. Right, get out. Okay. Some of you know my wife occasionally does family child care for people. She recently was the first person that parents had left a child with. Kid was almost 6 months old. So that means for nearly a half a year, mother had not been away from the child. I get so excited about that, I break the child. And it's often an anxiety-producing decision for people when they... You didn't feel bad at all. Just walked out. Yeah. I don't remember the first time we left our firstborn. I do remember a couple of times when the classic, absolutely classics happened. I'm trying to remember, but the child was, Glenn was several months old. We had left her briefly, but we hadn't gone out on a date. So we made hotel reservations, we got a nursing student to come. At the University of Pittsburgh, the nursing students had a babysitting service coordinated. Great service. They always had a backup if they couldn't do it. It was really cool. great moneymaker for the students. They advertised it, and we used it regularly. And so we got all ready to go, all dressed up. We were going to a very fancy restaurant, and got here we go. And there's a lot of anxiety about the departure, and I was trying to be the supportive other person, and my wife was very, this isn't going to work, this isn't going to work, I know this is going to be a disaster. So Daddy picks Gwen up and starts to carry her upstairs so she won't see us leave. And Gwen decided at that point she was going to spit up. So, you know, we did a quick sponge off, and I would go get in smell bed. Midway through dinner, oh, she was screaming when we left, of course. That always happened. And midway through dinner, the maitre d' comes through. Dr. Shelton? Dr. Shelton, I'm here. There's a phone call for you. So your heart goes where? Some flying them. I can't change her diaper. She couldn't change the diaper because Gwen was crying. And the poor student was in tears because she couldn't get the kid's diaper changed, and Gwen was crying. So she called me in the middle of dinner to tell me she couldn't. What am I going to do? Go home? So, what do? You decide you'll never go out again. Or, you, in my case, you give her good advice. Is she cleaned up? Yes, but she keeps twisting and I can't get the diaper on her. So, leave it off. But, put her in the bathtub if you're worried about it. Okay. She doesn't have to have a diaper on. Just follow her around. You know, carry her wherever. So she did. And if you really want the diaper on, there's a technique. Put her on the floor, on the rug. Put your knee on her chest. She will hold still. You're bigger than she is. But we figured that was classic, and that Gwen only did it because I was a child psychologist, right? So she wanted to test my ability to deal with that long distance. By that time, my wife was a basket case. I'm saying how to get a diaper on anyway. The things that you learn and you have to deal with, the people you have to incorporate into your meso system, the pediatricians, the emergency room eventually, all of those people who make life much more complicated than it was. And then the difficulty of maintaining familiar activities, the things you like to do when you're a couple by yourself. You jump in the car, you leave for the weekend, you get somebody else to feed the cat. No. You've got a kid, 45 pounds of stuff just to go out for the afternoon. You've got the bag, you've got the whatever it takes. You don't do anything very spontaneously because it has to fit with the child's schedule. You have to plan for all of the activities that have to be engaged in with the child wherever you go. So you've got to have the diapers, you've got to have something to clean the child up with, you've got to have whatever food because you can't go to McDonald's and get a bottle for the baby. You've got to have whatever it takes. And if the baby's going to sleep someplace, then you've got to have that. The nice things now are all of the convertible car seat that becomes a bed, becomes a crib, becomes a two-seater bicycle. I know they're very transformable now. Those have all been invented by parents who got annoyed with all of the difficulties of trying to be spontaneous. It just simply takes more planning. And that's easy for some couples, and it's very difficult for others. It's a challenge for everybody. But the first time around, you're wrestling with all of the changes within the microsystem and in the mesosystem, and the connections between the home setting, where you're set up to take care of the infant, and other settings that you might go to, that connection is much more cumbersome. It takes a lot more stuff to get there, a lot more planning. So if you go to visit parents, take the baby, you've got to plan for that. You've got to deal with whatever the issues are in that setting that may or may not be appropriate for a baby. For some people, currently one of the big issues for parents is they won't take their kids to visit grandparents because somebody insists on smoking in the house, and it's her house, and she is damned if she's going to stop smoking just because a grandchild comes into the house. That's a quote. I probably messed up one or two words, but it's a quote from a grandmother. And what was happening in the family and continues to happen is that the parents will not bring the grandchild to visit the grandmother because the grandmother insists on smoking in the house and won't suspend it. They've negotiated all of that, but the grandmother, in addition to being addicted to tobacco, is simply adamant that in her house she is not going to be told what to do. And she has a whole set of beliefs and principles that back that up, that she didn't raise her children to tell her what to do. She has always had a firm grasp of what is going to be acceptable, and her kids know that. And now that they're out on their own and disagree with her, she's really annoyed. She had already accommodated coming to their apartment and not smoking in the apartment. She smokes out in the hallway, which the other inhabitants of the apartment are not happy about. But she isn't happy. And the conflict with the extended family is not atypical. And you can multiply that. The smoking is the current one. Animals are another. Having dogs that run loose in the house when you've got a kid, a baby crawling on the floor who's not used to dogs, and dogs that aren't used to babies. You know, telling your friends that they're dogs that act like and are treated like children have to be outside while you're there is not comfortable for some people, so they avoid friends that they've had before. So when you're dragging the child around and trying to make the child safe and comfortable and keep it from completely destroying your activities and your relationships with friends and extended family, all of that makes the mesosystem connection, the congruence, the agreement about values and goals difficult. So some people find that their mesosystem shrinks when they have a child. Friends who don't have children sometimes are very interested for a little while. And you have people, friends who have children, and you know, after a while you get really tired of hanging out with them because they don't think about or talk about anything but the child. They just, their view of the world changes dramatically. All they want to talk about is the kid, and that's annoying. It's okay for the first half hour, but after a while, friends sometimes get annoyed. In the same way that people who have children all get together and they talk about the kids and they compare them, and that's very important to do. Very important part of parenting is to communicate with other parents about kids and what to expect and talk about it. But the people who don't have them eventually form their own groups of people who don't have kids. So there's a voluntary segregation in some parts of society. Okay, we're reconciling the imagined child with the child that we have, accepting the new role, learning to appreciate the partner, learning to value your partner as a parent, encouraging the partner's involvement with the child, and that should go both ways. Redefining the relationships with the extended family, and then trying to come back to a comfortable pattern. Trying to deal with the fact that you are now a parent, and some things are desirable, some things aren't, and you have to change the way you see yourself and the way you behave. So forming a relationship with the baby, and part of that is accepting that this baby is yours, it is your responsibility. That's an overwhelming responsibility for many parents for the first few months. They just have a great deal of difficulty making all of those adjustments. And just about the time they're settling in, a couple of months, they're beginning to sleep a little bit, they've figured out how to trade off, they've decided that sex once every couple of weeks is probably enough for now, and that's okay, and they've agreed on that. Just about 2.5 months, some percentage of kids get colicky. And colicky kids take their fussy period, and most kids have a fussy period during the day. Colicky kids take that and they fuel it and they extend it and they cry and they're not comfortable. You can't comfort them. They just cry. And they cry for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours every day, the same period. And they typically choose a time when parents would rather they didn't cry. Early evening, supper time is a favorite. When they wake up in the middle of the night is another favorite. Those are the ones that lead to infanticide. When you go for weeks without being able to comfort the child, it's not a huge number. It's about 15% of kids go through a serious period of colic, but it's not something they tell you about. It's not something that they train you to deal with, but it is a pretty good challenge for the parents' ability to adapt and to spell each other off and figure out creative ways to get the child to quiet, to calm down. It's a molar activity that most of us aren't trained for, and if you're lucky, it doesn't last all that long. It always goes away, but sometimes it doesn't go away for 6 or 8 weeks. And by that time, parents are wondering why they did this. Okay, enough of that. It's not all disastrous. It's not all grim. There's a lot of fun. Babies are cute. And it's fun to figure them out. I realized I was probably on the verge of convincing you all to get tubal ligations before you get much older. Babies actually are fun. It really is challenging, and it really is satisfying to be able to figure out how to do these things and to do them while you're doing other things, and how to have a relationship, how to sneak the sex in while the baby's napping. One friend of mine said the biggest accomplishment of his year was figuring out how, with the baby in the bed, to have intercourse with both of them having an orgasm without waking the baby up. This requires a lot of you got to figure out what your priorities are, and then you get creative about how to accomplish them and how to maintain the spousal relationship. That's important. Or you agree that it's not important, or that sex isn't an important part of it. But probably the biggest, here I am on the negative again. I was trying to be positive. One of the biggest challenges is, as Wallerstein said, maintaining privacy and space for the spousal relationship. And it's a huge challenge to keep the baby from taking over life. And people do lose sight of what their priorities are. So it's helpful, from my perspective, to decide that you're going to take the challenge of being a couple and continuing to engage in Muller activities just with each other and to nurture the relationship and work the baby into that. If you don't, then 6 years down the road, while you're giving your entire life to three kids, you're also losing each other. And it's not at all surprising that there are peak times for divorces. There's not one peak time, there are several. And one of the peaks is in the first year after marriage. That's when people decide this was a dumb thing to do and they shouldn't have done it, so they get divorced. And another is during the preschool years, when you have two preschoolers. That will drive a couple to divorce. The next is when you have two pubescent kids. Yeah, that's fun. The way to do that is to have a boy first and then a girl, 2 years apart. And since boys go through puberty a year and a half to 2 years later, then they'll go through puberty at the same time. So you have two kids who are completely out of sorts, don't like each other or themselves or their parents or anybody else in the world. And pubescent kids create conflict between parents. That's one of their jobs in the world. That's part of the role. And then the other is the empty nest. When you finally got rid of the kids, and they're all gone, and you realize that you didn't save anything in the relationship. So divorces are timed by children. Divorces are caused by children. And it's helpful to just make that very clear, because as I said on Monday, you can destroy a perfectly good relationship by having a child. And then we make it in our macro system unacceptable to blame the kid for the fact that you've destroyed the relationship. It's important to understand that the stress created by children will destroy the relationship unless the couple is aware of that and choose deliberately not to let that happen. That requires planning. That requires keeping your priorities straight. That means figuring out how to have satisfying sex with the kid in the bed or whatever else it takes. Casey.
I was just curious if people don't have children, is it around the same time you would say
couples? Or like, when they were childless couples don't have peaks. It's kind of, you know, some people argue that there's a 7 year cycle, that every 7 years it increases. But if you take out the children from that, you don't find that in childless couples. I don't know why they divorce or why the timing is, but it's not the kids that drive the timing for childless couples. Okay, what are the pleasures? Must be fun. Question is there a relation? I think the question is there a relationship between socioeconomic status? I don't know that anybody has looked at that. And the example is, so if you have two preschool kids and a nanny, would that reduce the likelihood of divorce? My guess would be no. And the reason I'm guessing is that nannies are a real intrusion in a household. If you think having a child or two is complex, working a nanny into the household on top of that, you have another person, a role that is often in conflict, competition between nanny and parents. It's very difficult for a nanny. Some of you have been nannies, and you know this. It's very difficult in many nanny situations to support the parents when the parents aren't supporting the nanny, when there's disagreement about how things should be done. Nannies sometimes are in the situation of being abused by parents, or having parents who don't support the nanny in actually turning the kids into acceptable human beings. Without naming names, I had a wonderful example last year, the year before. One of my a UVM student, took a job for the summer as a nanny. Three kids, great location, wonderful, and couldn't wait to get out. Absolutely incredible. Kids who had a nanny, at least one nanny a year, all of their lives, because the oldest was 10 or 11. These kids had 13 or 14 nannies, and they had figured out how to drive nannies absolutely bonkers. And they did it very well, and they drove her bonkers, and she had no interest in staying. She did stay as long as she was committed to, but absolutely no support from the parents. So, but maybe it meant that the parents didn't have to deal with the kids at all, and maybe they weren't going to get divorced because of that. If they'd actually had to deal with it, maybe they would have. I don't know of any research on that topic. It's an interesting question. But it is important, as you think about nannies or live-ins or full-time childcare at home, it's important to remember that you're putting that into a microsystem that you have to manage. And every person that you put into a microsystem makes it more complex. And as you add roles, it gets more complex, and those roles may be in conflict. So it's not easy having a nanny. It's not necessarily a reduction in stress. And then nannies quit, and nannies abuse kids, and nannies feel, and not UVM nannies. Okay, what are the good? I keep trying to think of the good things. The good things are, if it's working reasonably well and the couple has their priorities straight, it's a very wonderful molar activity to increase your developmental status on, to figure out how to do this. And how to do it together and how to collaborate. It can increase the appreciation the couple has for each other, and that increases their commitment to each other. If they're doing it badly, of course, the opposite is likely to happen. As kids get a little older, let's keep them young. One of the advantages of holding babies is that it's good for your health. It's good for your health. Hold a sleeping baby. Heart rate goes down. Blood pressure goes down. And if you focus on it a little bit, brain waves change and people relax. This is why people like to hold babies. This is why when I'm having a day that I'm not really sure that I like, I try to sneak in the child care center to the baby room and see if I can find a baby to hold. You know, because just those little bald heads, they're really nice. Just to hold. So you get those opportunities to calm down and slow down because you have to. People who are used to just going find that they have to calm down, and that's good for them. You can do thinking. I used to do the morning feeding with our kids, and I had a wonderful rocking chair that I could sit in and look across the river valley, the Monongahela Valley in Pittsburgh, at sunrise. and have the sun come up and shine through the purple pollution, the orange and purple pollution, the haze. The Monongahela Valley was at that time the most polluted section of real estate in the United States, worse than New Jersey. And we lived right there. And the sun came up through a beautiful technicolor, and I would have this wonderful 45 minutes or so in the morning of just being there and rocking and starting my day with a baby who was always happy. And you know, she'd sometimes go back to sleep and you know, sit there and doze. Didn't have to deal with anything. My wife would sleep, and that made her happy, so if she's happy, then I'm happy. It's a wonderful thing to do. As kids get older, you also get the opportunity to do all of those things that you stopped doing when you became a grown-up. And then you get to go back and do them. You get to go on all the playground equipment, and you get to be a fool, and you get to make funny noises, and you get to roll around in the grass and make a fool of yourself in all kinds of ways. And I recommend that as a molar activity, that you go back and do all of the crazy things that your kids do, and then continue to do them even after your kids are old enough that they don't want to do them anymore. It's kind of fun. If you haven't done it recently, to play terrorist on Church Street, you know, behind the rocks. Yeah. Every once in a while, if I'm out late, you may run into me. I may off you from behind the rock, or pretend to. Anyway, do those fun things. Engage in the fantasy. Don't watch television. Go down the slide. Do all of that fun stuff, and kids get you back in touch with that if you allow yourself to do that. And probably one of the nicest things, well, there are a couple of other things. We're going to get to one set of them when we talk about kids becoming involved with other families and other kids and institutions. Unless you have kids, you're not likely to be a member of the PTO in a grade school. You don't get to go to parents' nights unless you have kids. So it introduces you to a large number of settings in the community that are kind of interesting to know about. Parents also become more concerned politically. They become more serious politically. They're much more likely to become involved in community budgets, in school debates, in school budgets. They get involved because of their kids. If you look around at who is promoting activities in a community, who's spending a lot of energy to create opportunities for children, sometimes you get random people who do that, but most of the time it's parents. And that's good for the community and for the parents, and eventually for the kids as well. And then there's a wonderful effect, I'm going to call it a spiritual effect, of being connected to the stream of life that started with whatever the first critters were that evolved in the ooze, the primordial ooze, and then evolved to be human beings. And you have the DNA, and when you create a child, you pass that DNA on. And it's possible, if you stop and think about it, to realize that you are now, by that process, not only connected to your ancestors, whom you might like to forget, but you get more appreciation for them, but you're also connected to the future. And that's why one of the reasons parents sometimes just go stand and watch their children sleep. In part because they're so thankful they could finally went to sleep. In part because they're so stunned by everything the child has done that they can't even think of something else to do. So they just stand there and look at the kid and make sure it's breathing. But there's a connection to humanity and a connection to life with a big L that is created when you participate in that process. And parents appreciate that, and parents know what I'm talking about. Okay, then the kid does keep growing, and Galinsky gets us to what she calls the authority stage. And the authority stage comes about because the child becomes mobile, because the child becomes verbal, because the child becomes competent. It's usually not necessary to discipline or set limits on a child who can't move around, who isn't very competent. You can't tell them not to poop. You can't. You can't tell them when to fill their diaper. You can't tell them when to sleep. You can encourage them, but you can't make it happen. But as kids become more able to do things on their own, all kinds of things, then it becomes necessary for the parent to begin to set limits. And that runs the parent headlong, nose first, into how we feel about authority. We can live our lives very, very well without paying much attention to authority. As teenagers, we discover we don't like it. We learn to resist it. We get to UVM, and we discover we don't like it in the residence halls, and it's often abused. We become resident advisors, and for the first time, in many cases, we become resident advisors, and there we are trying to set limits on and control the behavior of other people who aren't that much younger than we are. And when you get into that role, you're forced to deal with how do you become an authority? How do you exercise authority when you have it? Some of you have that experience as camp counselors or as shift supervisors at McDonald's or other situations where you were in charge of other people and responsible to make them do jobs. My favorite authority issue was when I was 16. I had a summer job for 6 years starting when I was 14, and I started as a supervisor. For some dumb reason, they let me be a supervisor when I first started the job. I was a freshman in high school. When I was 16, my physics teacher in high school didn't have a summer job that year, so he came to work where I was working, and the boss put him on my crew. Ooh. Because he figured I was the only supervisor who would be able to deal with that. It was a very great compliment. He said everybody else would kill this guy. For a variety of reasons having to do with his personality, his appearance, there were all kinds of issues involved with people's relationships with this man, and many students and most of the supervisors were former or current students. Many of them would have taken the opportunity to make life miserable for this man. And I didn't. But it was very interesting to figure out how to tell your physics and chemistry teacher that the work he was doing was in considerable need of revision and improvement. And he also needed to pay attention to matching the numbers on things. He wasn't really very bright, was the problem. I really liked him, but he wasn't very bright. And so I had to train him to do a job that anybody who was about sixth grade could usually do. And that was the problem. It was such dumb work most of the time that supervising people doing it was a challenge because they didn't want to do it. So, here we are as parents. And kids, if they have any intelligence at all, are challenging their parents every time they turn around. If they've got spunk, if they're curious, they are making life difficult for their parents because they want to do things themselves and they don't want to check things out with their parents before they do them. So they just simply want to do them. And emptying the refrigerator is lots of fun once you can reach the handle and can open the door, and taking everything out is lots of fun. whether mommy's around or not. Putting the cat in the dryer is an interesting biological experiment. You can name, learning to strike matches is fun. So if you have a smoker in the house, striking matches is a very important skill to have, and when you're 2 years old, it's really kind of fun to set things on fire. A little scary, but you learn to control it. You learn to yell fire. And you can, learning to flush the toilet. I love it. Learning to flush the toilet and then figuring out the fluid dynamics of what will flush and what won't. And then there's an interesting thing in most of our physical settings. Proposition F applies here, and this is one of my all-time favorite things about physical settings and kids who are learning to stand up and control their motor skills. One of the fun things about bathrooms is that they have toilets, and toilets are really absolutely fascinating. You can put all kinds of stuff down them. And you can play in the water, and you can play with the dog, with the water, the dog drinking, all kinds of fun. And where do they put the toilet paper roll? It's fascinating coincidence that toilet paper rolls are often right next to toilets. And you know the old controversy about which way to hang the toilet paper? This used to exercise Ann Landers. She could never figure out why it was important. She was missing two things. And there are people who will insist that the toilet paper, this is the wall, toilet's over here. There are people like me who will insist that it go this way. So it hangs down this way. And that's because I lived in a house for 23 years, which if the toilet paper was hanging down the back and you reached for it, there was a seam in the wall right behind the toilet paper, and you jammed your fingernail into that seam. Never occurred to me to cover it, but I spent 23 years injuring my fingers and insisting the toilet paper goes that way. Except, you do not hang the toilet paper over the front of the roll if you have a toddler in the house. Then it goes on the back. You also don't hang it in the front if you have a cat in the house. Then it goes in the back. Cats and toddlers have a very similar motor skill, and you know what it is. It's one of the first motor skills that toddlers acquire. And do you know how long it takes to unroll the entire roll as you develop your motor skills? This is a very important motor skill. So flap, 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 flap. And it gets faster and faster and faster, and it's lots of fun. And you get the whole thing down, and you've got a 15, 16, 18-month-old just giggling, just hysterically about what he's doing. The cat doesn't giggle, but I had two cats that used to do that. I don't know whether they learned it from Gwen or Kiff, or vice versa. What do you do with toilet paper after it's all on the floor? Where does it go? Where do you put toilet paper? In the toilet. I hope you do. That's what you do with toilet paper, right? Goes in the toilet, you flush it down. The whole roll. Then you do another wonderful toddler motor skill. You scoop it up. Now you've got a whole arm full of paper, and it may take two, but you turn around, or you're already between, so you just pick it up, and you put it in the toilet. And it does this really neat thing. It gets all wet. It gets really wet. It gets soggy, and maybe there's more, so you take that. And so you've got the whole roll all loose, and then you play with that for a while. And it's kind of fun, because wet toilet paper begins to fall apart, and then you can plaster with it, like paper mache, all over the bathroom. And then you realize that you probably need to do something with this, so you flush. And then you learn to mop by watching the parents who are, by this time, dealing with the fact that you have ruined a whole roll of toilet paper. You have gotten water all over the bathroom floor because water is supposed to go down, but it can't because the outlet is plugged with wet paper. So it's going to go out. And that's kind of fun. So if nobody comes right away, that was sort of fun. But after a while, the toilet stops running. So the spectacle has ended. So what do? You flush it again. And again. Until a parent arrives, wondering why there's water running down the stairs. This does not come from personal experience that is unique to me. This comes from personal experience that is repeated over and over and over again. So, hang your toilet paper someplace else than in the bathroom. Okay. Don't put it over the front. And that is one creative example that can be multiplied how many times? 1,000? For each toddler. Each toddler will find 1,000 ways to apply competence and motor skills and curiosity and experimentation to learn how the world works and create a mess or get killed. There are all kinds of things that you can do. Screwdrivers? Screwdrivers are fun. Bobby pins. Paper clips. One of the things that we teach infants is to put things in. We have shape boxes. Okay. So we learn the shape of things that go in openings. We have dozens of toys that are designed to teach you to put things in other things. Toilet paper in the toilet. That's an interesting shape. What happens? Have any of you actually done it? When you put a screwdriver in there? The lights go out. All of them. Including the ones in your head if you're holding the wrong part of the screwdriver. If you're just holding the plastic handle, you can get by with this. You can get away with it. But all the lights in the house are going to go out because you just blew the circuit breaker. But there, all houses, all apartments have multiple wonderful things to arouse kids' curiosity. So if your child is alive, you have to learn to set limits. You can control some aspects of the physical setting. That's called childproofing. You childproof, you pick up all the breakable stuff, you put covers in the electrical outlets, you remove the cords that kids can strangle themselves on. You hang the toilet paper so it goes over the back. You do all the childproofing, and you still have a kid who's going to need limits set. And you're going to have a child who is going out in public more often. And out in public, kids begin to figure out how to behave or what the opportunities are. So you take the kid to the grocery store. The grocery store is designed to make kids mad. Unless you're the kind of parent who will give the kid everything that the kid can see. If your grocery store doesn't have an aisle with a sign over it that says, no candy aisle, parent aisle. They have different labels for it. The one that Hannaford says, this aisle has no candy or gum. That's the checkout aisle that you take your kids through, because otherwise they sit in the cart and it's narrow. Right? So the kid's sitting in the cart. If you're lucky, just taking one thing, but if you're not lucky, swooping everything off. And then it cascades down, and there you are, the parent trying to check out. People are bailing out. They don't want to be behind you. The kid has done nothing except practice one simple motor skill, and you've created something that is going to be embarrassing. And kids discover that this is really kind of fun. Mommy freaks out. Daddy screams. Everybody runs around. And it's really neat. You get the whole lifesavers. They go down, they clatter, they roll all over the place. It's lots of fun. This is a great playground. Why don't they let me out of this cart and let me just play? They've got these neat things when the kid does start to walk. I watched, when was I in the first? Monday evening. The guy in Hannaford had made a stack of pasta. He had, I don't know, probably 5-6 cases, and he'd made a circle in the pasta aisle. At the end of the pasta aisle, he'd made a circle about that big, boxes, and then he'd made another row on top of them, building with blocks, and then he went up, and it was about 5 feet high. And I looked at it and said, oh man, I just want to reach under and just yank one out. And you should have heard him gasp when the 2-year-old came. It was just like you do for a little kid. You build a block tower and invite the kid to knock it down. That's what he had done for this 2, maybe 2.5-year-old kid, running over. And he was going right through it. He was just—he absolutely knew what this was for. It was just what they do in daycare for him. He was going through it. I thought the guy was going to swallow his teeth, but he got there before the kid did. And he dealt with it very nicely. He kind of swooped the kid away. Yeah! And then I said, you did a great job. It's a nice tower. And I was very pleased that he didn't abuse the child. But it was, he just finished it like 2 minutes before. He was admiring it. He was still picking up the cases. It was a great playground. So what you're doing as a parent is having to deal with the fact that the kids have lots of competencies, lots of things they can do, many skills, and you're putting them in more and more settings where they can apply those skills and get in trouble. And you're putting them in settings where other parents are going to watch you and how you deal with it. So if you're the parent who's got the kid who's screaming in the grocery store, there you are, feeling like the whole world is watching you. You're a totally incompetent parent. And now the challenge is, how do you convince everybody else that you're a competent parent? Bribing the kid is not the way to do it. Setting some limits is the way to do it. Not responding, not giving in, not letting the kid control you. And at some point, if you're going to do the job responsibly, you have to figure out that this is not an environment where I can have this kid behaving this way. Therefore, you apologize and you leave your cart in the middle of the grocery store. And you say, I'm sorry, we can't do our shopping if you're going to behave that way, so we have to go. And you apologize to the manager. If the manager's smart, the manager says, it's fine, we'll leave it right there for a little while. You come back in and finish. But it happens all the time. And smart parents don't allow their kids to get away with behavior that's unacceptable in public. And you feel like your kid's abusing you. It begins to teach you that the child is not an extension of you. It has its own will. It can think of things to do. It will think of things to do that you would never have thought of, and it will insist on doing them even when you tell it no. So you're confronted with how to be an authority, how to set limits, and that violates your images. We have images about raising kids. No anger. You're always supposed to love kids, and they're supposed to love you. That's what the Gerber baby's about. You're going to be different from your own parents, and then you hear yourself screaming exactly what your parents screamed at you in the same situation. We like to think that children are always nice. Children are not nice. Children are curious. Children know no limits. Children have to learn all of the limits individually. And it's our responsibility as parents to teach them those limits. And when we do try to limit their behavior, they will behave not nicely to us. And it's kind of sad when your kid has learned to talk, and then you're in a situation where the kid looks at you and says, "I hate you, Mommy." Now, you taught him to talk. You're happy he talked. And there he is, hating you. You're the meanest mommy in the whole world. "I want to go with Daddy next time," you know, whatever it is. Kids are not nice to their parents, and children won't always stay the same. So Galinsky described each of these and said, these are the images that we're going to give up as we deal with authority. We're going to create skills that we may not have had before. Setting limits, deciding what they are, enforcing them. Being not nice to our children when they violate those limits. Taking them away from things. Taking things away from them. Frustrating them. Confining them. Removing them from our presence. It's called time out. You can't be with me if you're going to behave that way. And at the same time, trying to figure out how not to get into the power struggles with the kid. Because, believe it or not, kids will usually win if you let them get into a power struggle with you. Now, they have much more time and energy to win than you do, so you don't want to get into that. And since children are constantly changing, we have to try to figure out how to stay no more than one step behind. We're always behind, but you try to stay as close as you possibly can and figure out every time something goes wrong or every time you don't understand what's going on, what it is that just went on, so that you can keep up. The clock is 3 minutes fast. Issues that come up, according to Galinsky, are figuring out how to be an authority and how to help the other parent be an authority. It is not surprising that during this peak, the preschool, two preschool kids divorce peak, when you ask parents about their conflicts, it's about discipline. It's about parenting style. Because they are unable to deal with creating a united front that they agree on about raising the kids. And that disagreement is added to the other disagreements that they have, and they're bailing. They can't do it together. And they will often say, "I would rather raise my kids alone than with him." Or what he discovers is that he can be a wonderful parent without her. And ideally, that's what they do. They go off and become single parents and share it, and the kids get two good parents. But when they're with each other, they can't agree on how to do it. The same thing comes up in the next, because the second, when kids are two, that's one psychologist called that first adolescence. Kids are establishing their separateness, saying no, requiring you to be an authority. The next adolescence is when they go through puberty, when you have to do the same things all over again, but the stakes are bigger. And disagreements about parenting are a major component of the divorces at that point. Interestingly, when you get to the empty nest divorces, disagreements about parenting, not an issue. You don't have to deal with it anymore. Okay, so conflict with the other parent about how to be an authority. Issues about mentoring the child. How do you teach a child to behave appropriately, to understand the world in a way that allows the child to be self-regulating, so you don't have to stand with a fistful of the kid's hair all the time, directing them where they can go. How do you teach a child to regulate his own behavior? That's a problem. And some of us don't have much skill at helping kids develop their own skills. That's mentoring. Recognizing that you're more experienced and you can't just tell. You can't just order the kid to do it right. You, in fact, have to teach the child to do it. Another of the issues is childcare and generally the community. How do you establish your limits and enforce them when the child is spending a good deal of the week in somebody else's setting and they're enforcing limits that are different from yours? So the communication between childcare providers and parents becomes important, and discipline is one of the major disagreements between childcare providers and parents. Often, they have the same complaint. It's fascinating to me that when you listen to parents complain about childcare, they're not teaching the kid limits, and when you listen to childcare providers complain about parents, they don't teach the kid limits. It's interesting to get the two together and figure out what limits they would like set. It may be that they disagree on the behaviors that are appropriate. And then communicating about sexuality as kids become curious and start asking those questions about where babies come from and where they came from and where the next one is coming from. As kids get up to be three, lots of parents decide they're going to do it again. They've forgotten the early stages. Figure they want to try it again. And complications we'll get to Monday. Be sure you've read the Chess and Thomas chapter called Goodness of Fit. And we'll go from there. It really is 20 till now. Actually, it's 21 till. I'm giving you a minute. Enjoy it.